Hello, this is Al Reynolds. I'm from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next hour I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated May 25th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front page news above the fold. After a big entry, HTC reining back plans, by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Durham. After breezing onto the downtown Durham scene last year with plans to hire nearly 100 workers, Taiwanese smartphone maker HTC Corporation has tempered its ambitions. HTC now wants to lease out two-thirds of its office space at the American Tobacco campus. The company has hired a real estate firm to market and lease the space that only last year promised to become a high-tech zone in Durham. HTC began aggressively hiring in the fall, filling more than 50 positions with smartphone design engineers and technicians for the research lab it opened in Durham. More hires were anticipated, but now it looks like the company has decided to wait. Moreover, the person once in charge of the company's Durham operations, Ron Lukes, is gone. HTC officials maintain the company will continue to hire in the Triangle. Quote, HTC reorganized its design and technology teams across Durham, San Francisco, and Taiwan, end quote, says a company spokesperson. Continuing the quote, we continue to hire in Durham as needs dictate. There are positions open now, end quote. HTC leased about 47,000 square feet in 2011 in two buildings at American Tobacco, or enough space for about 150 employees. The company never moved employees into the second building. The pause is not surprising, but might be long-lived, given the battering that cell phone makers are taking in their competition with Apple Incorporated and its iPhone. Horace Dudieu of research firm Asimco tracks cell phone makers on the basis of profit share. In that regard, Apple was light years ahead of all competitors with 75% of profit share through the fourth quarter of 2011. HTC was fourth with a profit share of 3%. In terms of revenue, Dudieu says Apple had 39% of the total through the second quarter of 2011. HTC managed only 5.5%, placing it behind Apple, Samsung, Nokia, and Research in Motion. In 2011, HTC had a 17% market share in the United States, according to Gartner Incorporated, an information technology consultant. But worldwide, HTC's share was only 2.4%. Don Shoup and Heath Chapman with CBRE Raleigh represented HTC in the lease negotiations in Durham, but Shoup would not comment about the sublease and referred questions about that to HTC. An HTC spokeswoman, Lori Rodney, would not comment about the company's operations in North Carolina. HTC's contract for the 31,226 square foot in the Fowler Building that is offering for sublease extends through July 2022. The Durham location is one of three HTC research and development facilities in the U.S. The other two are in Seattle and in San Francisco. The Durham City Council approved a $150,000 incentives offer to HTC's U.S. unit based in Seattle, HTC America Innovation Incorporated, if the company created 99 jobs and invested $2 million by 2014 in Durham. The average salary was slated to be $125,000 a year. But HTC executives never signed the incentives agreement, and the contract was rendered null and void, says Kevin Dick, Director of Durham's Office of Economic and Workforce Development. No cash incentives were ever paid to the company. HTC was one of the early adopters of Google Incorporated's Android platform for mobile phones, and it sells different variations of its technologies under its own brands, which include the Evo, Desire, Droid, and OnePhone series. The company also is a contract manufacturer of cell phones for T-Mobile and other carriers. It's been estimated that HTC produced more than 50 different handsets in 2011. Next up, clawbacks on deck, next for public concerns, by Chris Bagley. From Raleigh, a new federal law will soon require publicly traded companies to recoup bonus pay that's based on incorrect financial information, and several companies in the Triangle have made clear they're willing to go after the money in moves known as clawbacks. The clawbacks provisions, which will apply to all public companies, have gotten particular attention since mid-May when J.P. Morgan Chase & Company CEO Jamie Dimon said his company may seek to recoup pay from one or more executives who presided over a $2 billion-plus trading loss. Local companies with clawback policies include software developer Red Hat Incorporated, Highwoods Properties Incorporated, and Duke Energy Corporation, which provides electricity in the Durham area and is attempting to acquire Raleigh's Progress Energy Incorporated. Clawback provisions are popular among shareholders in part because they're seen as assuring that executives are truly high performers and not merely goosing the numbers. Some studies have suggested that companies that have clawbacks outperform those that don't. Passed by Congress in 2010, the Dodd-Frank Act includes a wide range of new regulations governing public companies and, especially on the financial institutions where investments were viewed as putting the financial system at risk of collapse in 2007 and 2008. While a handful of companies have pledged to recoup any erroneous incentive pays, most of their policies apply only to pay that results from fraud or other egregious acts, and will probably need to be toughened to comply with the Dodd-Frank Act. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has indicated it will issue detailed rules for the law by the end of June. A 2010 study of 3,380 large U.S. companies by GMI Ratings, a shareholder advisory firm, found that only 19% had policies calling for clawbacks. Among companies in the S&P 500 index, 40%, 199 to be exact, had clawback policies, according to that study. GMI research analyst Paul Hogsden says those proportions have increased marginally since 2010. People who help determine executive pay say it's rare for a company to demand actual repayment, but they add that the deterrence factor and shareholders' perceptions are real. If you don't have a clawback policy, it looks like you're asleep at the wheel, says Christian Hyman, managing director for executive search firm Vaco Resources in Raleigh. People shouldn't be paid on stuff that's not real. Clawbacks are less common among privately held companies, Hyman says, in part because shareholders have less access to financial reports. They're most common among companies that have strong corporate governance structures with boards dominated by independent directors rather than executives, business professor Shane DiColi says. Clawbacks first gained wide attention in 2002 with the passage of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Section 304 of that law authorizes the SEC to pursue CEOs and CFOs who get bonuses and other incentives based on profit that turn out to have been intentionally inflated. While some companies went a step further by pledging to take the initiative in pursuing repayment, DiColi says the law hasn't been nearly as effective as the Dodd-Frank law is likely to be. The SEC has just got so many things on its plate, says DiColi, who teaches managerial accounting at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. It simply doesn't have the resources to litigate everything that might fall under Section 304. The new law will require companies to recoup any incentive pay that results from faulty financial statements going back 3 years, even if the executive's error was unintentional. The financial statements of the companies with such policies tend to be somewhat more reliable and transparent than companies whose clawback policies apply only to fraud, according to a study published May 2nd by three business school professors at the University of Washington. Few Triangle public companies address such unintentional errors. Raleigh-based Red Hat's clawback policy specifies, quote, fraud, willful misconduct, or breach of fiduciary duty that results in a material restatement of financial statements, end quote. Raleigh's Highwoods adopted a similar policy in 2010. Duke Energy's clawback policy adopted in 2007 refers to financial restatements as, quote, due at least partially to the recipient's fraud or misconduct, end quote. Progress Energy doesn't have one, but Duke's would apply to the combined company if the two companies complete their merger, Progress spokesman Mike Hughes says. Otherwise, Progress will adopt its own in compliance with Dodd-Frank, says Hughes. Today's lead article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, a victory for Novant. Administrative judge ruling returns case to regulators. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. An appeals ruling has given new life to Novant Health's hope of gaining permission to build a 50-bed hospital in Holly Springs. WakeMed Health and Hospitals and Rex Healthcare have received approval to add a combined 101 acute care hospital beds in Wake County, 50 of them to be in a new hospital in Holly Springs to be built by Rex. Novant, based in Winston-Salem, appealed the ruling, saying it should be allowed to add the beds. In response to Novant's appeal, Beecher R. Gray, an administrative law judge in the Office of Administrative Hearings, ruled in the hospital company's favor. That kicks the application back to the Department of Health and Human Services. Drexel Pratt, the director of the Division of Health Service Regulation under DHHS, will make a ruling on which hospital system may add the beds. He will take Gray's ruling into account but not necessarily approve Novant's application. In fact, some local hospital leaders believe the decision will not change from the original ruling. Quote, we doubt that the director of DHSR will agree with Judge Gray's ruling, says Stan Taylor, WakeMed Vice President for Corporate Planning. Acute care hospital beds are important to hospitals because they determine how many patients and therefore how much revenue a hospital can generate. They are the foundational block for an acute care hospital, says Don Dalton with the North Carolina Hospital Association. Through what is called the Certificate of Need process, the state regulates the number of treatment beds allowed in various service areas throughout North Carolina. The DHSR determined that Wake County needed an additional 101 acute care beds, and WakeMed, Rex, and Novant each bid for some or all of the beds. In September, the DHSR awarded 50 beds to Rex for a $137 million hospital Rex plans to build in Holly Springs. And 51 beds were awarded to WakeMed, which plans to add 29 in its Raleigh campus and 22 in its Cary campus. Novant, which owns Franklin Regional Medical Center in Lewisburg, received none of the beds and appealed the ruling. Pratt has 2 months to make his new ruling and will hear arguments from each hospital system as to why they agree or disagree with Judge Gray's ruling, explains Lee Whitman, a CON attorney with Wyrick Robbins. After his decision, any party may make another appeal, but this time it would be to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. That process could take up to 18 months. Whitman represents Harnett Health System, which will open a 50-bed hospital in Lillington in early 2013. Harnett Health contends that a new hospital in Holly Springs, about 20 miles from Lillington, would negatively impact its new hospital. Harnett Health leaders take no issue with adding beds in Wake County, but they say they should not be added in Holly Springs or anywhere so close to its service area. As with all matters under review or litigation, Jim Jones, a spokesman for DHHS, says it would be inappropriate for the agency to comment on the ruling. Through spokesman Alan Wolf, Rex expects it will prevail and win approval to build a 50-bed hospital in Holly Springs. Novant, through spokeswoman Katie Everett, says it agrees with Gray's ruling and looks forward to a new ruling from DHHS. Now, inside the front page, Bandwidth may take Red Hat campus space. By Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. A chunk of the former Red Hat space on North Carolina State University's Centennial campus may not stay vacant for long, as executives with fast-growing Bandwidth.com in Cary are studying a relocation and expansion. Sources say talks between Red Hat and Bandwidth.com are serious as Red Hat prepares to begin its move to downtown Raleigh in June. Bandwidth.com has added 100 positions since January 2011, boosting its employment base to 275. The company expects to add at least another 30 positions before the end of the year, and almost all of them will be in the company's Cary office, says Chris Chang, Bandwidth.com's chief operating officer. The company will be hiring software engineers, iOS and Android developers, and IT managers. Bandwidth.com is negotiating to lease almost all of the space in the Venture 3 building that Red Hat will vacate on Centennial Campus, sources say. Chang would only confirm that company executives are looking at a number of buildings around the Triangle, including Centennial Campus, and that they are looking for more space than the 55,000 square feet the company currently occupies in Cary. Red Hat has been trying to find a tenant to take over lease payments for the 72,418 square feet it occupies in the Venture Center 3 building, as well as all of its 120,000 square foot headquarters building at 1801 Varsity Drive on Centennial Campus before it moves to downtown Raleigh. Red Hat is paying about $1.8 million annually for space in the Venture 3 building, according to company reports filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Rich Harris of Synergy Commercial Advisors in Morrisville is representing Bandwidth.com in its lease negotiations, but he reverted questions to Bandwidth.com's executives. Bandwidth.com, which has traditionally targeted small and medium-sized businesses as customers for its Voice over Internet Protocol, or VOIP, network, has introduced and expanded a couple of other business lines in the past year that have taken off. They include the company's iNetwork wholesale voice network business that has opened up opportunities with larger companies such as Google Voice, Skype, and Pinger. They've done a pretty good job at selling, says Chris Clausen, principal analyst with New Paradigm Resources Group Incorporated in Chicago, which tracks the telecommunications industry. And they were at the right place at the right time and were able to recognize that opportunity, says Craig. Bandwidth.com, founded in 1999, ranks among the top 10 service providers in the country for hosted VOIP, according to Infinetics Research. By Clausen's estimates, privately held Bandwidth is posting annual revenue around $120 million, which has been growing at a rate of 15% to 20% a year. We expect that pace to pick up further as folks who have been hanging on to traditional phone services migrate over, he says. Bandwidth.com in November introduced its first direct-to-consumer product called Republic Wireless. Next up, Extreme Hires from Foes as it grows in RTP, by Lauren K. Ansonge, from the Research Triangle Park. Extreme Networks is growing its development operations here as well as abroad, and to do so, the Santa Clara company is plucking off talent from other tech concerns, including Durham's Cree Incorporated and competitor Cisco Systems. Extreme Networks Research Triangle Park headcount now stands at 120, up from 90 in November, says Christina Brunk, the company's information development manager. She says other hires will be made in the coming months. To find the people needed to sell the company's products and services in Ethernet switching and network management, Extreme has made at least two hires from the ranks of Cisco Systems. CEO Oscar Rodriguez told investors on May 2nd that new additions include a Cisco alum now heading his company's Asia sales operations and another heading sales operations in India. The hires of Joy Ghosh for the Asia job and Chiradeep Rao for the India job was announced in May 1, but Extreme did not say where the two had been posted with Cisco. Quote, "We've taken our time to hire the right people, but they're going to need their time to get on the ground and get things moving," Rodriguez said. In perhaps the biggest coup, and in a move to right a listing bottom line, Extreme on May 22nd announced the hiring of Cree Incorporated's CFO, John Kurzweil, as its new CFO. The loss of Kurzweil to the much smaller Extreme was a blow to Cree, but he landed an offer that will allow him to work out of Extreme's RTP offices, though he will spend time in Santa Clara. Wedbush securities analyst Rohit Chopra calls the hiring a big deal and a potential signal to investors of Extreme's potential. Quote, "Kurzweil must have done his due diligence to look at Extreme," he says. The change in leadership is timely, Chopra says, citing a rugged third quarter for which Extreme reported revenue of $75.7 million, down from $89.8 million in the second quarter. That resulted in a third quarter net loss of $3.6 million, compared to a gain of $2.6 million in the second quarter. Citing the new sales executives, Chopra says the CEO has made some changes in the sales organization to make sure that doesn't happen again. Capstone Investments analyst Jonathan Keyes says Extreme's next step is gaining market traction. "In an ideal world, build it and they will come," he says. "It's not as slam dunk as it used to be." Indeed, Extreme faces big challenges, not the least of which are tumbling economies in Europe and a general slowing of spending in information technology. The company's RTP operation is a strategic outpost for the development of technologies that can grab share. Not only is the workforce being expanded, Extreme's Vice President of Engineering, Gavin Cato, is based in RTP. A company spokesman, Greg Cross, says RTP is where some of Extreme's most innovative products are created, citing its Black Diamond X8 switch as an example. Earlier this month, Extreme announced new 10 gigabit Ethernet copper modules for the core switch, following a move toward copper that predicts experts will become the primary choice for cloud and data center network upgrades in the next 2 years. While relatively small, with fewer than 800 employees, compare that to Cisco's 72,000, analysts say Extreme Networks is gaining some looks. "There's good potential for people to start paying attention to Extreme," Chopra says. Brunk says the company will probably be adding space in RTP to accommodate growth, hopefully by the end of next year. Moving on, success scene for takeover bid by Chris Bagley from Raleigh. While Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated path to acquire its larger industry rival has become considerably steeper, analysts and investors say they still expect the hostile takeover to succeed. The effort so far has come at significant expense to the Raleigh company. Martin Marietta's last two quarterly reports attribute a total of $41 million in legal expenses to the takeover attempt, which it launched on December 12. For now, the issue rests in Delaware courts, one of which ordered Martin Marietta on May 14 to withdraw its tender of offer for Vulcan Materials Company, the only U.S. company larger than Martin Marietta that mines gravel and sand for construction projects. Martin Marietta was proposing to exchange one of its shares for every two shares of Birmingham, Alabama-based Vulcan. Martin Marietta complied with the order and withdrew the offer, but the company is scheduled on May 31st to argue its case before the Delaware Supreme Court. Meanwhile, the two companies' share prices have continued to move nearly in unison, reflecting what several financial analysts say is an investor expectation that Martin Marietta will eventually succeed. Most notably, both companies' shares fell by a bit more than 8% on May 16th, after a prominent hedge fund manager suggested that Martin Marietta was overvalued. "We think VMC, Vulcan, will continue to trade closely with MLN," Martin Marietta, KeyBank Capital Markets research analyst Rodney Nasir wrote in a May 21 research note. Analysts and legal experts acknowledge the hurdles that Martin Marietta face. The court's order blocks the company from resuming its attempt until mid-September. In practice, that means Vulcan shareholders would not get a chance to vote on it until May 2013, or June 2013, unless Delaware's Supreme Court takes action on May 31st in Martin Marietta's favor. Several analysts suggest that a loss that day would merely force Martin Marietta to sweeten its offer from the 1-for-2 exchange ratio, which implies a value of about $4.4 billion for Vulcan. Longbow research analyst Garrick Schmee says he believes a sweetened deal could still make economic sense for Martin Marietta. The company could raise its offer in late September, prompting Vulcan shareholders to demand that their company's executives and directors return to the table. In the course of the trial in Delaware in March, Vulcan and Martin Marietta officials divulged that they had discussed a combination off and on for years before breaking off talks in mid-2010. Vulcan executives and directors have vigorously opposed the hostile takeover attempt. Several large Vulcan shareholders initially spoke out in support of Martin Marietta's bid, but Schmee noticed that they've been more quiet since Vulcan announced a reorganization in late December. Schmee also notes that Martin Marietta reported a much larger loss in the first quarter of 2012 than in the first quarter 2011, potentially undercutting its argument that it could improve Vulcan's operations. Martin Marietta representatives didn't respond to questions about whether they would resume a takeover bid in September if the appeal fails on May 31st, but they've indicated they'll resume the takeover attempt if the appeal succeeds. Next up, finding propane cheaper, companies convert fleets. By Chris Bagley from Raleigh. Propane-powered vehicles have made surprising inroads alongside ethanol-powered vehicles, gasoline-electric hybrids, fully electric vehicles such as the Chevrolet Volt, and buses that run on compressed natural gas. Yes, propane, the stuff that grilled your steaks last weekend. A relatively small but growing number of businesses are converting their fleets of cars and trucks to propane use, according to propane dealers and business owners. The Propane Education and Research Council, an industry-funded group, estimates that 290,000 propane-powered vehicles are in use today, with at least 15,000 added each year. They point to propane's superior efficiency in terms of miles per dollar. While propane is 10% to 15% less efficient than gasoline on a miles per gallon basis, it's also 31% cheaper based on triangle area averages in mid-May. $2.50 a gallon versus $3.61 for regular unleaded. Converting a vehicle to propane use can cost $5,000 to $15,000, but fleet owners who have made the switch say the investment can now pay off after a year or so, depending on how a vehicle is used. They point to gasoline prices, which rose an average of 96% between March 2009 and March 2012 in the Southeast, according to the U.S. Energy Department. In comparison, propane prices rose 67%. Some propane companies offer multi-year contracts that limit price increases so that the investments will still pay off even if propane prices rise or gasoline prices fall. Turf Service Incorporated, which landscapes commercial properties in the Triangle and Triad, converted three-quarters of its mowers to propane use early last year at a cost of a little bit more than $1,000 each, co-owner Greg Blazer says. People in the industry say organizations such as police agencies and for-profit transportation companies that made the investment recently typically did so because their operations are fuel-intensive. One recent convert is the Hyatt Place, Raleigh West, off Chapel Hill Road, which has a propane-powered airport shuttle. General Manager Michelle Pfeiffer says, Michael Pfeiffer says he isn't sure he'll fully recoup his $15,000 investment, but he considers the reduced emissions the right thing to do. Propane's relatively lower price has a lot to do with the proliferation of hydraulic fracturing, says financial analyst Ave Feinberg, who covers oil and gas companies for Morningstar. Also known as fracking, the technique pumps high-pressure water and chemical solvents into the underground rock to release fossil fuels. Propane is usually found alongside methane or natural gas. Propane is less plentiful in those rocks, but more valuable than natural gas, Feinberg says. And while it's more expensive than natural gas as a fuel, engines equipped to run on propane are also much cheaper. In the last 2 or 3 years, the propane supply has been growing significantly, Feinberg says. Propane also got a big boost in 2009 when federal stimulus money began to fund tens of thousands of conversions. Local government agencies were the first to adopt propane in large number and are still the largest user of propane in motor vehicles. In the Triangle, the Raleigh Police Department and Knightdale Police Department have propane-powered patrol cars. Grant money is scarcer now, but Blazer and several other business owners say the investment still pencils out. While the 14 conversions of Turf Services Cary location relied on government grants, Blazer says it converted its mowers in Greensboro entirely with its own funds, and that he expects the fuel savings to cover that investment by sometime next year. Private sector sales have come to account for about 40% of the vehicles that Alliance Auto Gas converts, says Steve Whaley, an Alliance sales representative in the Carolinas. They're adding to their fleets even without any stimulus, he says. One recent customer is a Chapel Hill company that delivers medical supplies, he says. Greg Ezel, sales manager for TransTech Energy, a propane company in Rocky Mount, estimates that converting a vehicle pays off after about 100,000 miles. It's a small contributor, but it's a growing part of our business, Ezel says. Further inside the Triangle Business Journal this week, Hexatech Walks in Footprints Left by Cree, by Lauren K. Ensange. Morrisville. Having already raised more than $14 million in three previous funding rounds, leaders at Hexatech now are looking to land another $3 million from investors. The 10-year-old North Carolina State Semiconductor spinoff, which currently employs about 25 people, would use part of the money to add another 10 to 15 employees by year-end. It's all part of Hexatech's goal to execute an ambitious plan to be like Cree Incorporated, another NCSU spinoff that now boasts more than $1 billion in revenue. Although Hexatech is far from that lofty sales milestone, in the past it has secured financial support from some notable partners, including VC backers like Durham-based InterSouth Partners, HIG Ventures, and Seven Rosen Funds, as well as $5 million in grants from the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. Hexatech officials declined to disclose detailed financial information. Durham-based Cree helped develop what's known as silicon carbide, or SiC, technology, an advance that helped spawn explosive growth in LED lighting. Hexatech is working on what's called aluminum nitride, AIN technology, a next-generation silicon technology that can be used to create LEDs that have functions well beyond lighting a room. For example, one product line being explored by Hexatech is the development of ultraviolet LEDs that can generate such intense light they can deactivate bacteria and viruses in water. They say their wafers also can be used to efficiently convert power to create additional sources of alternative energy. At the core of the company's work is a process for growing crystals, the basis of semiconductors, that Hexatech scientists say perform better and last longer than existing crystals. Sletko Sitar, co-founder of the company, is a professor of materials science and engineering at NCSU. He says Hexatech is now working to raise $3 million as it heads towards the production phase of its products. CEO Joe Gribbs says the workforce will be increased by 10 to 15 employees by year end, mostly in production and engineering. Ramon Collazo, an NCSU researcher and professor, says the advance to AIN technology is major because even though previous generations of LED could handle a lot of power, the substrate foundations absorb wavelengths of UV light that were crucial to applications in sterilization and water treatment. Quote, "We couldn't move forward," Collazo says. "Now we can actually develop the technology fully, as it was intended." Three teams of NC State researchers have contributed to Hexatech, says Professor Doug Irvin, and a number of them have become Hexatech employees. It opens up career paths for them, he says. While Hexatech will continue to sell its LED components to companies, this summer it will begin sending out samples of its LED products with the hope that finished LED products will be rolled out in the next year. Greg Thompson, Director of Business Development, says the company is actively looking for investors and he hopes Hexatech can follow in a path blazed by Cree, which would lend further credence to the academics and research at NC State University. "This area continues to spawn great companies born out of the materials science side at NC State," says Thompson. And now, Vocus leaders vow eye contact will move forward with firm. By Lauren K. Alsons from Morrisville. 3 months. That's how long it's been since Morrisville-based Eye Contact was acquired by Beltsville, Maryland-based Vocus, a move that has, according to Vocus COO Bill Wagner, yielded no regrets. No regrets for the company, that is, but for 75 Eye Contact workers that were laid off, the $170 million acquisition turned out to be a bitter one. The exit of co-founder Ryan Allis, always the front man for the email marketing company, also turned out to be an abrupt one, though sweet, given a payday in the millions of dollars. After pronouncing the layoffs necessary but regrettable, Allis resigned, saying he wanted to pursue a master's degree. Wagner says the remaining Eye Contact workers are meshing into the Vocus culture, which he describes as an unabashed meritocracy. He says there will be no other layoffs as part of the consolidation. He adds that the Morrisville office has nearly doubled its sales team since the acquisition and continues to have openings. He puts the number of employees in Morrisville at 160. That's down from 250, the number Alice said were on board in February. "Our goal was to move quickly to identify redundancy and treat people fairly so as to eliminate the uncertainty," Wagner says. "It's never easy to go through a transition like this, but we are now in a position to move forward and grow as one company." New salespeople have been hired in Morrisville to sell not only Eye Contact's email marketing products, but also the Vocus marketing suite, which has no email component. Vocus spokesman Frank Strong points to the company's job listings website, where 10 jobs in Morrisville are listed, ranging from client relations to sales to information technology. "You can see that we're hiring a number of jobs in North Carolina," he says, adding that some of the open positions are multiple hires. Eye Contact's email marketing software rounds out Vocus's platform, Wagner says, and that's the goal Vocus CEO Rick Redman expressed in February. Now, the Vocus suite will include email, which is a vital component of a digital marketing suite, Redman said then. Going forward, Wagner says the Morrisville office will be a key component of Vocus's operations, even to the point of maintaining the Eye Contact brand. We plan on making significant investments in the physical office here in the Triangle, he says, though he is not specific on the nature of the investments. iContact proved to be a solid success story in the Triangle Tech community. Alice and co-founder Aaron Houghton met at UNC Chapel Hill and started iContact while still in school. The pair netted CED support in 2003 and after the acquisition donated $270,000 to the organization, which Houghton says provided them with encouragement and credibility during the early years. Houghton has moved on to a new startup, Boost Suite, a web marketing product for small businesses launched in September. iContact, outstaying its founders, is now the email and social media marketing services arm of Vocus, a public company with more than 1 million users of its cloud-based marketing and PR software. But Vocus remains a work in progress financially. On revenue of $114.9 million in 2011, the company posted a net loss of $14.6 million. Next up, Mears, six others sign on with Tammy Lynn. Jean Mears has taken her work with children to the Tammy Lynn Center for Developmental Disabilities. Mears and six contract therapists joined Tammy Lynn in April, and it's worked out well, says Mears and Lillian Matthews, Tammy Lynn's Community Services Director. Most early intervention therapists work as independent contractors, which helped make the transition easier. Essentially, instead of contracting with Mears, they now contract with Tammy Lynn. As far as services go, we didn't miss a beat, Mears says. Tammy Lynn works with people of all ages, but Mears and her therapist focus on children younger than three. Tammy Lynn used to have a very robust program for such early interventions, but due to changing reimbursement models in the mid-2000s, saw that program decimated, says Matthews. With the addition of Mears and her team, Matthews hopes to see that grow again. The Tammy Lynn Center has 210 staff positions, 18 contract positions, and 20 part-time nurses on staff. Next up, UNC Health foresees declining income. By Jason DeBruin, from Chapel Hill. After three straight years of increased operating income and margins that grew to double digits, the University of North Carolina Healthcare Systems Projects declines for the current year and next year. To be sure, the numbers are still strong. For this year, UNC Healthcare is on pace to generate operating income of $104 million, but that's going down from $118 million last year. Going forward, the system projects operating income to decline to $86 million for 2013. As for margins, the system reported a 6.2% operating margin in 2011, which it expects to come in at 4.6% this year and 3.6% next year. Declining profits for UNC Healthcare can be attributed partly to some of the same issues that face all healthcare providers. An aging population will put more patients on Medicare, and with the federal government looking to slash budgets, providers fear that will mean lower reimbursements. The North Carolina Hospital Association estimates that hospitals across the state will experience $7 billion in reimbursement cuts in the next decade, says Don Dalton, a spokesman for the association. He says, where we would love to see margins on a gradual decline statewide, it's simply not been that way. At UNC Healthcare, there are other factors at play. UNC Hospitals, the system's complex of hospitals in Chapel Hill, has 799 licensed beds. Rex Hospital, a hospital in Raleigh owned by UNC Healthcare, has 433 beds. While that might sound like a large number, Karen McCall, UNC Healthcare Vice President of Public Affairs, says the system's capacity and therefore its profitability margins are squeezed. The UNC Hospital Systems has two projects underway that will increase its beds count to 862, but UNC officials project that will only keep up with population growth. In capacity figures submitted to the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, UNC reports a licensed acute care bed capacity of nearly 80%. DHHS has a target occupancy of 75.2% for any hospital with more than 200 beds. As with most businesses, hospitals mostly benchmark each other on operating figures, but they also generate income or losses off investments, which affect the bottom line. In terms of net income, the decrease in margin is even more stark, largely due to investment income or loss. In 2011, UNC Healthcare earned $126 million in interest and investment income, a figure it expects to shrink to just $13 million this year. Look no further than the stock market to explain that difference, McCall says. Indeed, from July 1, 2010 to June 30, 2011, the system's fiscal year, the Dow Jones Industrial Average showed a 28% gain. From July 1, 2011 until the end of last week, on the other hand, the Dow posted a nearly 2% decline. Chris Ellington, UNC Care's Chief Financial Officer, and other top leadership were not made available for comment. This week's guest opinion is from Governor Beverly Perdue. Governor Perdue is the governor of the state of North Carolina. This letter is entitled Exploring Alternative Energies. As prices at the gas pump continue to put a strain on our families, we are all focused more than ever on the importance of a sound, forward-looking energy policy. Our nation's critical energy needs must be met if we are going to compete and win in the global marketplace. In North Carolina, a successful long-term strategy will include a comprehensive mix of energy sources, both traditional and renewable, along with innovative improvements to energy efficiency. We can and will create jobs, reduce costs on businesses and families, and keep our economy growing, all while we protect the environment and our natural resources. As governor, I have promoted solar technology, expanded new job opportunities in the nuclear industry, and worked with our federal partners to move North Carolina forward quickly in the development of wind energy. These innovations, new technologies, and energy sources will provide more and more supply in the years ahead to meet a growing demand. One important energy strategy is natural gas, which has become a more affordable and reliable source of fuel. It's domestically abundant and historically cheap, in large part due to new hydraulic fracturing or fracking technology. The North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources, DENR, recently issued a final report on fracking that found that, quote, production of natural gas by means of hydraulic fracturing can be done safely as long as the right protections are in place, end quote. I carefully reviewed DENR's report, having participated in numerous scientific and policy briefings on the issue, and had countless conversations with various stakeholders. As I reflect on all these experiences, I am committed to helping move the state forward on energy. I believe that fracking can be done safely if properly regulated. This is consistent with what I have said since day one of my administration, which is that we must have a reasonable approach to every form of energy production and let science, not emotion or politics, drive the debate. My goal is now, and always has been, to bring jobs to North Carolina by supporting industries that foster America's energy independence, and to do it in a way that protects the public health, landowner rights, and the environment. North Carolina needs a strong set of standards in place before we allow fracking here. Fracking can create jobs and help lower energy costs. Before we permit anyone to frack in North Carolina, however, we must hear from all sides, address all issues, and develop a robust set of rules. First and foremost, those rules must put every necessary precaution into place to protect our drinking water and safeguard the health and safety of every single North Carolinian. The rules must also protect the interest of landowners and address the needs of county and municipal governments. That's why I issued an executive order recently that establishes guidelines and creates a framework for considering the type of standards that must be developed before any energy development begins. As governor, it is my job to ensure that as the state prepares for this growing industry, North Carolinians are protected, and that any exploration or development of natural gas or any energy source is done under the highest standards. Continuing on this week's opinion page, this week's guest column also is from Harvey Schmidt. Mr. Schmidt is the CEO of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. This column is entitled Ripple Effects of Early Learning. More than 85,000 North Carolina high school seniors are preparing to graduate. I have some questions for them. Are you a team player? Do you have strong writing skills? Can you think critically and communicate effectively? In short, do you have the soft skills that businesses increasingly are demanding in their new employees? If the answer is yes, you are much more likely to land a job than applicants lacking these skills. The sad truth is many of you are facing huge challenges. You just don't have these critical soft skills. In my many years working with business leaders in North Carolina, I have watched with growing frustrations the difficulties that high school graduates face, whether they go straight into the job market or seek a 2- or 4-year degree. Businesses are frustrated too. In a recent survey, 60% of North Carolina employers report communication skills gaps among job applicants, while close to half of employers reported deficiencies in critical thinking and problem-solving abilities. Making matters more challenging, experts predict that between 2008 and 2018, two-thirds of all new jobs in North Carolina will require some type of formal education beyond high school. So now what? How do we ensure our graduates have the skills that are key to sustained economic growth? The answer may surprise you. Start educating our children earlier and do it better. Of course, we must continue to train and retrain our current workforce and support work-oriented programs in our high schools and universities that can produce graduates who are well-prepared to succeed in careers after school. But the whole education process must also begin earlier for us to achieve real change. Research shows that high-quality early learning programs help children begin to develop critical literacy and math skills while simultaneously learning crucial soft skills, like how to follow directions and how to work in a team. These basic social skills are prerequisites for acquiring further knowledge in school and in the workforce. According to a years-long study of North Carolina's own ABCDarian early education program, participating students were 4 times more likely to earn a 4-year college degree by age 30 than those who did not. Additionally, participants were 42% more likely to have been consistently employed than those not in the system. An extensive research shows that children who participate in high-quality early learning programs are significantly more likely to enter school with the underlying skills they will need to succeed in school and later in the workforce. High-quality programs can increase language skills, lower the need for special education, lower dropout rates, and increase graduation rates. Particularly important to businesses, quality early learning programs increase rates of employment. Children who attend quality programs are much more likely to be employed at age 40 than their peers who do not. We don't have to wait 20 years for these economics benefits, but according to the business leader organization America's Edge, investing in quality early learning will actually generate immediate local economic activity as high or higher than investments in sectors like construction, manufacturing, and transportation. In fact, a total of nearly $2 is generated for every $1 invested. Over the long term, studies also show that high quality early learning can save as much as $16 for every $1 invested because kids who participate in these programs can grow up to be better educated and more productive workers with far less remedial education or criminal costs to society. That is a return on investment that cannot be matched by almost any other public investment. In Washington, our congressional delegation is tasked with education reform, and both Senators Burr and Hagan serve on the key committee that is tasked with that effort. I hope that they and the rest of our delegation will press for shifting our educational system from the traditional K-12 approach toward one that includes a focus on early learning. In order for America to remain competitive in what has truly become a global market, our workforce must be top-notch. Early learning is a key part of that effort. After all, it's not just good for kids, it's a smart move for business. And now, bad news for golfers, good news for students. St. David's School, a private Episcopal K-12 school, is in the process of buying the 30 acres on which the Capital T golf practice facility now operates on Yonkers Road near New Bern Avenue in Raleigh. The school will develop the land for its athletic fields and facilities. "We think that's going to be a great site to develop for both competition and practice fields that we need," says David Bowman, St. David's Director of Advancement. At its campus on White Oak Road near Six Forks Roads in Raleigh, Bowman says there isn't enough space for the athletic fields. Already, the school rents space at various venues and teams practice on the competition fields. Capital T has been run by PGA professional Jimmy Hamilton since 2006. He offers lessons at Capital T and told Triangle Golf Today that he is confident he will find a new place to teach and coach. Hamilton has played in 3 PGA Tour events and the 2010 Senior PGA Championship. Bowman says the land sets up perfectly for athletic fields and expects to have grading and seating done in time for the spring sports season of 2013. The school is in the process of finalizing the sale price and working on a master plan for the site. The fields will be about a 5.5-mile drive from the school. Thanks to local investments from the Wake County business community, more than 30 Wake County public school teachers will receive classroom grants for the 2012-13 school year. The recipients of the teacher leadership grants will collect a whopping $80,000 to use in the classroom. Plans for the money vary, but include algebra lessons via iPads and group reading sessions with Amazon Kindles. The grant program is made possible by the Wake Education Partnership, a nonprofit formed in 1983. 8 companies contributed to the 2012-13 grants with the goal of improving local education. The 34 grant winners will be wined and dined at a reception sponsored by Duke Raleigh Hospital on May 23rd. Cheers. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.